The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 23/August 30, 2021. It has the usual red border on the front page. It has Time in large block letters in a pale whitish gray, superimposed upon a darker background, and the lettering is nearly obscured by four individuals. These are the first all-civilian spacecraft people, two men and two women. Moving now into the text of Time magazine, beginning with the page entitled The Brief, Defense Department. It's a photograph of a bunch of young men and women in their khaki camouflage uniforms. A couple of them are seated at a desk next to laptop computers. I should say a table. It's a folding table. With chairs and laptops. One of them is wearing the camouflage uniform. The other has camouflage pants and a khaki shirt with some type of insignia on the back, which I can't read. All of these individuals are wearing masks, and the people in line are also wearing caps that match the uniforms. They're in an outdoor setting because it looks like a patio and grass beyond, with a building, a structure, just next door to where this table is set up. The caption reads, Defense Department, U.S. Marines are pictured preparing to receive the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine at Camp Hansen in Kin, K-I-N, Japan, in April. About 73% of active duty military have received at least one dose of a vaccine as of August 9, according to the Department of Defense. Under a new plan backed by President Joe Biden, COVID-19 vaccines will be added to the list of immunizations required for U.S. troops. To defend this nation, we need a healthy and ready force, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said in an August 9 memo. The next entry on this page is under the subtopic bulletin. The title is Fate of Infrastructure Bill in Hands of House Democrats. This is written by Philip Elliott. You could feel the relief in Washington August 10 as the Senate advanced a bipartisan infrastructure bill that would fix roads, rails, and pipes across the U.S. For President Joe Biden, it is potentially a legacy project, but any celebration would be premature, as the fate of $550 billion in new spending is at best uncertain. Progressives in the House are warning they may think it They may tank it unless they also get Senate approval for a $3.5 trillion companion package that could pass with only Democratic votes. So as lawmakers headed home for the August recess, they left behind a lengthy to-do list for their return. Nuts and bolts, clean energy projects, highway overpasses, public transit upgrades were bipartisan priorities in the infrastructure plan. Leaders have punted on these issues for years. The White House now estimates that one out of every 5 miles of highway in the U.S. is in poor condition, and 45,000 bridges stand at serious risk. The agenda is not sexy, but it is a down payment on deferred upkeep that officials in both parties have recognized puts the nation's economic future in peril. Systemic inequity. In many instances, the bill includes huge piles of cash to close the gap between rural and urban communities, including $65 billion to get broadband internet to the estimated 30 million U.S. households that cannot reliably get online. An additional $15 billion comes to replace lead pipes in the 10 million homes with contaminated water supply lines, although experts say the cost of a real fix would be closer to $45 billion. And the measure also has carve-outs to reconnect neighborhoods divided by existing infrastructure, such as highways that plow through the middle of black neighborhoods. Continuing negotiations. The bill still faces challenges in the House, where Democrats have little room for error. Progressives say they may reject the package unless they get another bite at the buffet. They're seeking a second plan that would pay for universal pre-K, 2 years of college, and what climate activists call a Green New Deal. And Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she will take up the Senate's plan when she can match it with a package that fights poverty and climate change. From the news ticker, three brief items. Marburg, M-A-R-B-U-R-G virus, reported in West Africa. West African authorities have located the region's first known case of the deadly Marburg virus after a death in Guinea, the WHO said. August 9, health officials have raced to contain the spread of the highly infectious disease from the same family as the virus that causes Ebola. Epstein accuser sues Prince Andrew. Virginia Giuffre, G-I-U-F-F-R-E, a longtime accuser of Jeffrey Epstein, filed a lawsuit against Prince Andrew, August 9, alleging the British royal sexually assaulted her when she was 17. Prince Andrew denies the charge. Meanwhile, about 150 sexual abuse victims received nearly $125 million from Epstein's funds. Cuba opens up private sector for businesses. Cuba legalized small and medium-sized businesses August 6 in a boost to the private sector. The country's communist government has promised to update its restrictive economic models after mass demonstrations in July highlighted Cubans' despair over a worsening economic crisis. More from the brief news. Good question. Will athletes' mental health remain a priority post-Olympics? Even before Simone Biles threw the Tokyo Olympics off their axis, Jessica Bartley knew mental health issues were weighing heavily on athletes. Bartley, a psychologist and director of mental health services for the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, says her team received about 10 support requests daily during the games. The games are really an incredible opportunity to start to have those conversations, says Bartley, whose group was the first to travel with Team USA specifically to support athletes' mental well-being. Taking place amid a pandemic that's had a massive impact on global mental health, the Tokyo Olympics were always going to present additional challenges for competitors. But once Biles pulled out of the women's gymnastics team event, the issue became a defining theme. Her decision, magnified by a global spotlight, created a rare opportunity to move the discussion from raising awareness to taking action. Biles' fellow Olympians recognize the gravity of the moment. With everything that Simone has gone through, I'm really proud of her, says Alex and Felix, Team USA's most decorated track and field Olympian ever. and the way she's standing up for herself, but also making things better for others. For Olympians, the burden of expectation can be debilitating. Not only is their performance the culmination of years of training, sacrifice, and physical struggle, but the personal stakes are amplified by having their individual success held up as the symbol of a nation's hopes. That pressure may be particularly acute for elite athletes because many are at a point in their lives when they are more likely to face mental health issues. Research shows that such issues are most likely to affect people during their teens and young adulthood. More young people are visiting the emergency room for mental health conditions and also turning to crisis intervention services like hotlines or online therapy. For the athletes whom Bartley and her team worked with at the Games, Biles is helping create a new path, one that can value results and medals, but does not put them above all else. That's far from the current norm. Few athletes feel able to take a step back without risking their place on a team or deal with a sponsor. The right mindset can go a long way toward ensuring longer and healthier careers, Bartley said. Hopefully, this reframes how people look at athletes, says Alex Bowen, a member of Team USA's men's water polo team. It is not all about what you are, but what you're trying to be. The Olympics are about trying to become your best self, and it is okay to get help to become your best self. That was written by Alice Park, Tokyo, with reporting by Sean Gregory, Tokyo. A small inset here with some very tiny inset photographs. Sports Olympic pride. A record 183 out LGBTQ athletes competed in the Tokyo Olympics, according to news site OutSports. They represented at least 30 countries, though notably not Japan, and took home more than 30 medals collectively. Here are some of their big wins. The first one is a team, Sue Bird and Diana Taurasi. The two Team USA veterans each scored their fifth gold in Tokyo, a record for any basketball player. Their victory extended the team's Olympic winning streak to 55 games. Its last loss was in 1992. Nessie Petizio, that's N-E-S-T-H-Y space P-E-T-E-C-I-O. The boxer's silver medal makes her the first woman to win a medal in the sport for the Philippines. This fight is also for the LGBTQ community, Petizio told reporters after losing the gold medal bout. Tom Daley, D-A-L-E-Y, the openly gay British diver, finally won gold in the men's 10-meter synchronized platform diving competition at his fourth Olympic Games and knitted between events, crafting a pouch for his medal. Quinn, Canada's first gold medal in women's soccer, was also history-making for the team's midfielder, who became the first transgender and non-binary Olympic athlete to receive a medal of any kind. From the brief news ticker here, three more very short articles. Mexico sues U.S. gun companies. The Mexican government filed a lawsuit against major American gun manufacturers August 4, accusing them of contributing to illegal arms trafficking to drug cartels and other criminals. The suit alleges the firearm companies failed to properly monitor their distribution systems. Unrest over religious sites, S-I-T-E-S, in Pakistan. Authorities in Pakistan have arrested 50 people over an August 4 attack on a Hindu temple. The unrest came in response to the court's decision to release on bail an 8-year-old Hindu boy charged with blasphemy. The boy, accused of urinating at a religious site, is the youngest person to be charged with the crime in the country. Unruly airline passengers on the rise. The Association of Flight Attendants reported an unprecedented increase in disruptive passengers in the first half of 2021, with more than 600 incidents investigated by the Federal Aviation Administration, almost double the number from the two previous years combined. Here's the brief milestones page. It features a portrait of someone not new to the television news, Governor Andrew Cuomo, at a COVID-19 vaccination site in New York City, March 17. He's wearing a dark blue, navy, I would say, jacket and a white shirt open at the collar. That's all we see of him, the shoulders on up. Grayish hair combed back, and he has brown eyes, and he's looking toward the camera but not quite at it. It looks as if his mouth is preparing to open to speak. And of course, the title of this article is Resigned: Andrew Cuomo, New York Governor Felled by Harassment Report, by Vera Bergengruen. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced his intent to resign from office August 10, 1 week after the release of a damning investigation by the state's attorney general left him teetering on the edge of impeachment. The long-awaited report into a slew of sexual misconduct allegations found that Cuomo, 63, had harassed 11 women by kissing, groping, or making suggestive comments, creating a toxic culture of fear and intimidation in his office. "What he did to me was a crime. He broke the law," said Brittany Camiso, one of the women accusing Cuomo of groping her, in an interview with CBS News that aired August 9. "The governor needs to be held accountable." It was a stunningly rapid fall for the powerful three-term Democrat, the scion of a political dynasty who just a year ago was hailed as a national hero for his response to the pandemic's first wave in New York. Daily press conferences sold him as a steady foil to the Trump White House in the chaotic early days of COVID-19, leading to a $5 million book deal and rumors of a presidential run. More recently, however, he has faced investigations into whether his office provided false information about COVID-related deaths at nursing homes, as well as into his alleged use of state resources to write and promote his memoir. But years of alleged predatory behavior finally caught up to the famously combative governor, who acknowledged the legal drama of an impeachment would cripple his administration. Cuomo has steadfastly maintained he had done nothing wrong and resisted previous calls for his resignation by the New York Democratic Party, top congressional Democrats, and President Joe Biden himself. But state lawmakers had begun laying the groundwork for impeachment proceedings, and as his aides and allies were increasingly caught up in the report's fallout, his position was untenable. "Given the circumstances, the best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to government," Cuomo said in a televised statement, "and therefore that is what I'll do." The circumstances are striking for a politician who positioned himself as a champion of women during the Me Too movement. Cuomo had previously called for the resignations of politicians facing similar allegations and proclaimed there should be a zero-tolerance policy when it comes to sexual harassment. But while he blamed a generational shift in his resignation statement, saying he didn't realize the extent to which the line had been redrawn, Cuomo had previously touted his record of signing bills to combat workplace sexual harassment, declaring in 2019 they should honor all the women who have endured this humiliation. The report in Cuomo's conduct alleged he and his advisors had sought to discredit and retaliate against some of his accusers, questioning their motivations and character. His resignation, effective August 24, made Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, H-O-C-H-U-L, the first woman to serve as governor of New York. Cuomo's deputy of almost 7 years, she will have to govern in the scandal's aftermath and the ongoing battle against another surge in COVID-19 cases. I agree with Governor Cuomo's decision to step down, she said in a statement following his announcement. It is the right thing to do and in the best interest of New Yorkers. There's a small inset photo of her, previously Lieutenant Governor, now New York Governor, Kathy Hochul, who is Cuomo's replacement. She is New York's first female governor. She is looking straight into the camera lens and smiling broadly. In this photo, we see her from approximately the waist up. She's wearing a bright red dress, a black belt, over which there is a dark, perhaps either very dark navy or black jacket. She's wearing a thin necklace around her neck. She has long, flowing, chestnut brown colored hair, and she's got her eyes crinkled as if she's looking into the sun, so I'm unable to determine the color of her eyes. Time, the world at a crossroads. This is an essay where West meets East. The Asian century has begun, but it has its shortcomings too. By Klaus, K-L-A-U-S, Schwab, S-C-H-W-A-B. There's a photo here. It's dark, dark as night, black background. And the caption reads, "Hundreds of drones form a light show in Shenzhen, China, December 2020. There are skyscrapers galore. Apparently they're glass because they're reflecting all sorts of light from the sky. Some are tall and pointy like a rocket ship. Others are quite square looking, but tall and square looking. There's one that says 222-88888 on its side at the top floor. And in the background, there is a light show. It looks like a follow the dots kind of thing. It's almost a reflection of the skyscrapers themselves in colorations of blue, violet, red, pink, other shades of blue, almost an aqua blue. This in itself, along with the skyscrapers, is reflecting into a body of water, which goes from the edge of the skyscrapers. It hasn't always been easy to discern from a Western vantage point. But the rise of China and Asia has been the most important economic development of the past four decades. In 1979, many Chinese people had an average income of less than a dollar a day. Today, Shenzhen, China's tech capital, has a per capita GDP of almost 30,000. The city is home to tech giants such as Huawei, Tencent, and ZTE, and a maker movement of tech startups. And in many other Chinese cities, including Hangzhou, Shanghai, and Beijing's Zhongguancun, home to TikTok creator ByteDance, made equally impressive progress. When I visited the country for the first time in April 1979, it was still reeling from two centuries of turmoil. But China's new leader, Deng Xiaoping, had already begun pursuing an experimental set of policies borrowed from Singapore called reform and opening up. In its early days, it consisted of creating special economic zones. In cities such as Shenzhen and Fuzhou, foreign direct investment was welcomed, and many features of a market economy were introduced. The economic development it spurred was then used as a flying wheel to create further growth and learning down the road. It turned out to be a runaway economic success. China's growth soared, and by the early 2000s, it entered the World Trade Organization. Around the same time, it started to gain a technological edge in various manufacturing industries, including electronic hardware, appliances, and textiles. And little by little, it began exporting its own growth model to other emerging economies in the region. As a result, just as growth in the West slowed, it skyrocketed in Asia. By its own calculation, China has lifted 740 million of its own citizens out of poverty. It averaged double-digit growth for over three decades, and it helped many other emerging markets achieve higher growth rates, too. As a result, the Asian century has already begun. According to some measures, 2020 was the first time in two centuries that Asian GDP as a share of world GDP at purchasing power parity was higher than that of the rest of the world. The historical importance of this evolution cannot be underestimated. The last time Asia dominated the world economy was in the early 19th century, as the first industrial revolution got underway. Today, at the dawn of the fourth industrial revolution, Asia's reconnecting with the dominant position it held for millennia. But how did China achieve this success? The system that enabled it to leap ahead could be summarized as state capitalism. It's undeniably capitalist, as the private sector produces more than 60% of GDP in China. But the system's also state-dominated, as the state retains its primacy over other stakeholders in at least three ways. It keeps a strong hand in the distribution of both resources and opportunities. It can intervene in virtually any industry. And it can direct the economy by means of large-scale infrastructure, research and development, and education, healthcare, or housing projects. The state capitalist system contrasts to the system of shareholder capitalism dominant in the U.S. and much of the Western world. In that system, the interests of shareholders dominate over all others. Companies operate with the purpose of returning the highest possible dividends to shareholders, and the theory goes the invisible hand of the market ensures the outcomes for society are optimal. In the 1980s and 1990s, shareholder primacy led to a long period of economic growth in the U.S. and turned it into the most prosperous nation on Earth. Both the economic systems championed by the U.S. and China have thus led to tremendous economic progress over the past few decades, but each has equally brought about major social, economic, and environmental downsides. They led to rising inequalities of income, wealth, and opportunity, increased tensions between the haves and the have-nots, and above all, a mass degradation of the environment. Those shortcomings in the West are well documented, but they're equally present in the Asia region. Consider first the environmental crisis. Many cities in emerging markets are among those experiencing the worst effects of environmental degradation, pollution, and climate change. Over 90% of the world's population breathes air the World Health Organization deems unsafe, the organization said in 2016. But the 20 most polluted cities are all in Asia. China and India in the past few years were also responsible for the lion's share of new coal and gas plants. In recent years, awareness about environmental concerns, such as air pollution and CO2 emissions, has grown a lot in China. The country pledged to become CO2 neutral by 2060, that's 2060, but it has a long way to go. The issue of inequality is a major challenge for China and other Asian economies as well. China's inequality almost continuously increased from the start of Deng Xiaoping's reforms until around 2010. The policies it pursued, the World Inequality Lab wrote, caused unprecedented rises in national income, but also significant changes to the country's distribution of income. In the years since, the rate of inequality growth does seem to have slowed in China, but the resulting picture is still one of significant economic disparity. As the two global superpowers race for economic and political superiority, the question can be raised which of their economic systems is the best recipe for building prosperous and stable societies. But it's a false dichotomy. Neither shareholder nor state capitalism works for all people and the planet. Wealth generation today requires a very innovative economy driven by entrepreneurial spirits. But modern societies do not tolerate excessive inequalities anymore, and using our natural capital has a delayed cost as well as an increasingly intolerable impact on all those who suffer from climate change and pollution. This is why it's imperative to put social, environmental, and good governance objectives at the heart of society. Doing so is possible under a third system, stakeholder capitalism, in which the interests of all stakeholders in the economy and society are taken on board, and the welfare of our people and our planet and progress are embedded in its genetic system. Stakeholder capitalism would fit many Western societies well, given the damages done by focusing only on short-term profits, not long-term sustainability and equity. But it would benefit China and emerging Asian economies too, given the shortcomings of state capitalism. It's time policymakers and business leaders around the world consider implementing it. This text was adapted from Stakeholder Capitalism, A Global Economy That Works for Progress, People, and Planet, by Klaus Schwab and Peter Vanham. Life and Death in a Hotter World, written by Justin Warland, with photos by Adam Ferguson for Time. The first photo here on this title page is that of a child, a boy, playing in an inner tube. It's a very colorful inner tube. It looks like a donut with sprinkles on it, white, orange, and pink with colorful sprinkles. He's in a body of water within the inner tube, but he's also reaching towards the bottom of it. And the backdrop is a large, what looks like sandstone cliff, as if it were something rising out of the Utah or Arizona desert. Turning to the text now, the August 9 warning from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, could not be more clear. The reality of climate change is unequivocal. Its effects are already playing out in every region of the planet. And we need to act now before the outlook gets worse. In a 4,000-page report, the UN's climate science body laid out in methodical detail the ways in which human activity has set life on the planet on a collision course. Today, the effects of climate change are already pervasive. If we continue to emit greenhouse gases at current rates, the effects of climate change will be catastrophic and irreversible. Recent changes in the climate are widespread, rapid, and intensifying, unprecedented in thousands of years, says Co. Barrett, a vice chair of the IPCC. It's a revelation both shocking to read and perhaps painfully obvious for the countless people who are already feeling the effects. From Germans whose homes were wiped away by floods this year to farmers suffering from ongoing drought in Central America. In the U.S., the nascent climate crisis appears most dramatic in the West, where a combination of drought and extreme heat has created life-threatening conditions. Now, here's a portrait of a woman sitting in what looked like a cool room. There's artwork on the walls behind her. She's seated on a red, I'm going to call it divan. It doesn't really look like a family room sofa. But she's wearing a strapless black dress, a miniskirt type deal, with black short boots. She's looking into the light. She has very short, dark, spiky hair. She's wearing a silvery colored necklace and rings and either bracelet or watch. She has red lipstick on. She has more artwork also up against the wall, a sculpture in a gold or a gilt finish. There's a pillow next to her on this red furniture that looks like a cat with sparkly blue feet, a bluish and silver lamp on an end table, large coffee table books on a steel and glass coffee table in front of her, another round glass and steel table towards the other side of her with some ornamental glass work on it. The caption reads thus, Palm Springs, California, June 18. Jill Langham and her friend Jeffrey Martin Sir planned to have drinks together in the evening. The desert city was experiencing a heat wave. For 43 consecutive days in June and July, temperatures hit 100 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. The soles burned off Langham's shoes that day, on which the high was 119 degrees Fahrenheit. Sir planned to lie out near a pool before meeting up. At close to 5 p.m., he texted to say he was winded but on his way. He never arrived. Langham didn't think much of his absence. Their plans were casual, and they were due to have brunch that weekend anyway. She later learned Sear, C-Y-R, 55, collapsed and was transported to a hospital, where he died the next day from complications of heat stroke. I really wish I had sent him a photo of those shoes and said, "Hey, be careful out there," she says. Would he have listened? He was a sun worshiper. Time sent photographer Adam Ferguson on the road across six western states from Arizona to Washington for more than 5 weeks in June and July to document how climate change is shaping life on the ground. He captured images of empty reservoirs and families who lost loved ones to unbearable heat. He encountered farmers worried about watering their crops and saw the devastation left by wildfires. It's a searing warning from a particularly iconic region on a planet that is, in so many places, on fire, parched, or underwater. The IPCC report, a collaboration among 234 authors, cites more than 14,000 studies and references covering all the shifts that are occurring in the environment, from the way water circulates to the level of moisture in soil. At the core of all these changes is heat. Global average temperatures have ticked up about 1.1% centigrade since the Industrial Revolution, according to the IPCC. But that seemingly small number obscures the enormous and immediate spikes in temperature in particular places. Heat waves that bring high temperatures that extend for days have become more frequent. And some areas, particularly vulnerable regions like the Arctic, are warming faster than others. These higher temperatures have a range of trickle-down effects, an altered jet stream, more intense drought, and even increased precipitation, to name a few. The next portrait is of a young man standing in a partially finished room. It's headlined Goodyear, Arizona. The room has visible insulation in just a rather rudimentary structural situation with bracing and very narrow railings, really. There's a window, and there's an American flag being used to cover the window because there's light streaming in behind the flag. There's a calendar hung on one of the framing options on one of the walls, two recliners, a gray and a brown one, a couple of end tables or side tables in brown and red, something like a radio or perhaps a reproduction of a Victrola on another table. A clock on one wall, and it shows the time to be 3:45. And there's a young man standing in the center of the room, dressed in blue jeans, a black t-shirt, with kind of a flag bandana wrapped around his head. And he has a long, kind of scraggly blonde beard and long, kind of scraggly blondish hair. The caption reads, Jody Marquess, 43, that's M-A-R-Q-U-E-S-S, looks at the recliner where his stepfather, John Raymer, died June 17. It was Marquess's birthday, but he was concerned about the 69-year-old who eschewed air conditioning. He had tough guy syndrome, Marquess says, recalling a stubborn and very frugal, but also honest and simple man. When Marquess stopped by that day, the high reached 115 degrees Fahrenheit. He installed a portable AC unit for Raymer, who was sleeping. 2 hours later, when he returned to drop off ice cream, Raymer was dead. From April through July, Maricopa County confirmed 47 heat-associated deaths, more than triple the figure confirmed by the end of the same period last year. Marquess had long wondered if this was how Raymer might die in Arizona. I just didn't think it was going to be this soon. Here's another photograph. It's a page and a half. There's a beautiful either sunset or sunrise, depending upon the orientation of the direction here. A purplish lavender violet sky at the top melding into yellow and orange and darker purple. And it's behind, the sun glow is behind some hills with some trees on one side. But in the foreground, it looks like kind of a... I don't know. I'm going to read the caption here because it's in the light in the foreground and in the dark shadows in the background. It's El Dorado Hills, California. Okay, here is what it is. Boat docks rest on the floor of Folsom Lake, a reservoir on the American River in the Sierra Nevada foothills, about 25 miles east of Sacramento. As the state's ninth largest reservoir, Folsom serves as a vital source of drinking water for millions and irrigation for the Central Valley, which produces one-fourth of the food consumed in the U.S. June 30, as California ended one of its driest rain seasons on record, the reservoir registered just 30% of its capacity. This drought is real. Climate change is real, Governor Gavin Newsom said 3 weeks later, standing bone dry in what in typical years would have been waist-deep water. If you don't believe in science, please, you've got to believe your own eyes. By August 10, with nearly half the state classified as experiencing exceptional drought, the highest level used by the U.S. Drought Monitor, the water had dropped 6% more. So there's this zigzag complex of either concrete or metal structures on top of some parched soil, which is actually a lake bed. Moving back to the text, any one of the ripple effects would create serious problems if it struck on its own, but when multiple ones land at the same time, the result is exacerbated. That's what's happening right now in the western U.S., where residents are experiencing what the IPCC has called a compound extreme event. Heat has evaporated the water supply for farmers and ranchers, not to mention local communities. States have reported hundreds of excess deaths as bodies collapse without air conditioning in unmanageable temperatures. And heat has led to drought, which has dried up forests and created tinder for wildfires. It's the combination of heat waves, drought conditions, and also windy conditions that allow fire propagation, says Paola Andrea Arias Gomez, an IPCC co-author and associate professor at the School of the Environment at the University of Antioquia in Colombia. That has led to record numbers. Last year, California experienced the worst fire season on record. This year, the state's experienced nearly three times the acreage burn compared with the same in 2020. The U.S. West is not alone in inhabiting dire climate straits, straits. For the first time, the IPCC this year offered a comprehensive analysis of climate change at the regional level. Every region on the planet has already taken a hit from warming in one form or another, according to the report. In places where people are already facing devastation, the scale of the climate-changed reality is starting to seep in. In the air-conditioned Oregon Convention Center in Portland, Dennis Henry, 71, tells Time he would consider moving if the heat waves became a regular occurrence. Henry had taken shelter in the cavernous meeting hall, a temporary fix, he acknowledges. If the situation became extreme, where this was semi-normal, no, I wouldn't be here, he says. But at the same time, I can't plan where to move because who knows what they're going to be like. Policymakers from around the globe are currently gearing up for global climate talks meant to put the world on track to keep temperatures from rising more than 1.5 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. The IPCC report will give ammunition to those of us who are saying this is a crisis, says Nat Keohane, president of the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. But so, too, should the stories of those on the ground who have already lost homes, livelihoods, and loved ones. This has reporting by Adam Ferguson, Andrew Katz, and Julia Zorthian. Now, there's one more photo here. It looks like a landscape from the moon or Mars or someplace where I've never been. Tall timber without any foliage. It looks like giant sticks standing in parched soil that doesn't even look like soil. It's grayish, bluish ash. There's some kind of a contraption in the mid-foreground that looks like it might have once been an all-terrain vehicle or some kind of a garden tractor or something. It's stripped to the metal. And there's a big barrel, like a gas barrel type of thing, I think, in the foreground, upon which is seated a man wearing pinstripe like Oshkosh Bagosh overalls, no shirt, but he's got a red pen in his pocket, and he's got kind of a crumpled up blackish gray cap. He has gray tinged brown facial hair, and leaning into his leg is a beautiful brown hound dog. It has some black and white brown ticking on various parts of it. This is captioned Sycan Estates, Oregon, and that maybe is supposed to be Sycan, S-Y-C-A-N space, Estates, Oregon. Jeff Whitehead sits among his destroyed belongings July 22. The bootleg fire, which for a time was America's largest of the year, scorching over 413,000 acres, generating its own weather, arrived just like a freight train, says Whitehead. It looks like a freaking bomb went off. The 63-year-old had been helping clean up the wreckage of his brother's burned-down house when flames reached his own. guitars and amplifiers, snowmobiles and trucks, engine parts, chainsaws, a huge cache of hand tools, much more, all gone, Whitehead says. This sure was a beautiful place, he says. It doesn't leave a beautiful memory with me, not this picture of it. At the grave of his partner on his 12-acre property, wind chimes used to hang in the trees. Whitehead recalls asking why she wanted so many of them, to which she replied, "When I'm gone, baby, you'll know I'm still there when you hear 'em." After the fire, he says, "I can't hear one. They're gone. Every wind chime." Time's Time Off section features the 100 best young adult books of all time. Now, this was written by Eliza Berman, Judy Berman, Madeline Carlyle, Peter Allen Clark, Lucy Feldman, Annabelle Gutterman, Katie Lang, Shay Montz, and Megan McCluskey. I will read some of these. Building Bricks by Jason Reynolds. The first time I ever thought about what my house was made of was when I learned it could be blown down by wolves, big bad wolves. Sure, The Three Little Pigs was supposedly a fairy tale about hard work, but for me it was a warning about my own safety. And though I soon dismissed the fables read to me at bedtime as childish, that need to know I was safe never waned, especially as the wolves became real. Here are a few examples of the 100 best young adult books of all time. 1868, Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. So much about female adolescence has changed since the 19th century, yet Little Women endures thanks to the timeless archetypes embodied by each of the sisters at its center who face illness, grief, and the agony of young love. 1908, Anne of Green Gables by L. M. Montgomery. This first installment of the 8-book Anne series, in which the headstrong heroine is sent to adoptive parents who had wanted a boy, is a classic that captures in equal measure the joys and sorrows of growing up. 1943, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith. Smith's semi-autobiographical novel follows young Francie Nolan, the daughter of first-generation Americans, as she navigates the seemingly inescapable cycle of poverty that plagues her turn-of-the-century community. 1947, Anne Frank, Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank. A book that should not exist, Anne Frank's diary is also a miracle, a document that places the incalculable atrocity of the Holocaust in terms comprehensible to children, even younger than Frank was when she wrote it. 1951, The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. In the 70 years since expelled prep school student Holden Caulfield first rallied against the world's superficiality, the character's grown into an icon for generations of readers, likewise wrestling with looming adulthood. 1954, Lord of the Flies by William Golding. Philosophers have long debated how human beings would behave in a so-called state of nature. Golding performed that thought experiment on a troop of preteen boys stuck on an island after a plane crash, a haunting vision of child turning against child that keeps gaining new resonance. 1960, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. Lee's classic 1930s set novel about young Scout, her brother Jim, and their lawyer father Atticus Finch traces the loss of Scout's innocence as Atticus' defense of Tom Robinson, a black man falsely accused of raping a white woman, ends in injustice and tragedy. 1967, From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler by E. L. Konigsberg. When 12-year-old Claudia Kincaid decides to run away from home, she whisks her younger brother Jamie off to New York City to live in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Their joyful adventure delivers unexpected twists and turns. 1968, A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin. In the magic-infused archipelago of Earthsea, that's one word, the wrong mistake could unleash an ancient and terrible evil upon the world. That's the lesson that a prideful young wizard must learn while training at the Island of Rokes School of Wizardry in Le Guin's debut installment in a beloved series. Returning to the introduction now by Jason Reynolds with one more paragraph, the books on this list and the countless other greats that are not, the contemporary, the historical, the fantastic, the irreverent, the sweet, the political, and everything in between, can be brick houses for young people, frantically patting what feels like the flimsy walls of their lives to confirm their safety. Or better yet, when they really work, books can serve as bricks for young people to build themselves into the houses they are searching for. Houses that cannot be blown down. Houses with enough rooms to entertain and board countless guests as they grow into safe havens for others. There's an illustration at the beginning of this section with Jack and Roger from Lord of the Flies, Ralph and Piggy from Lord of the Flies, Meg, Jo, Amy, and Beth from Little Women, and other characters from other books that perhaps I will be able to describe to you at a later date. The photo of the young man in the inner tube I just found the caption for. It's Page, Utah. Keithan Tsotsi, 9, swims off Lone Rock Beach in Lake Powell while visiting from the Many Farms, Arizona area of the Navajo Nation, June 12. Hovering at around just 32% of capacity as of August 10, America's second largest reservoir has reached a low unseen since it was filled in 1969. In the past year, the water level dropped some 52 feet. Well, Keithan Tsotsi, 9, looked like he was having some fun anyway. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. This is Patricia, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.